That was the year.
Recreating notable events of passing time, reviving memories of men and women who have contributed to the history of a modern world.
...1931, that was the year. The Vatican, January 8. For the first time in the history of the Roman Catholic Church, translations of a papal encyclical in five other languages in the customary Latin were published as Pope Pius XI, after more than 2 months of preparation, issued his eagerly awaited 16,000-word document, Gestae Canubi, of chaste wedlock, denouncing birth control, divorce, and the so-called trial marriage.
In spite of what others may wish to assert and spread abroad by word of mouth or in writing, let husband and wife resolve to stand fast to the commandments of God in all things that matrimony demands, always to render to each other the assistance of mutual love, to preserve the honor of chastity, not to lay profane hands on the stable nature of the bond, to use the rights given them by marriage in a way that will be always Christian and sacred.
1931, that was the year. Philadelphia, January 19. Transatlantic cables began to sizzle following an address before the Contemporary Club by bombastic Smedley D. Butler, Major General of the U.S. Marine Corps, holder of 2 Congressional Medals of Honor, in which he was asserted to have accused Premier of Italy, Benito Mussolini, of responsibility of the death of a child when his automobile bearing an unnamed American was said to have struck the child and spun past without stopping. Immediately, Mussolini cabled the Italian ambassador.
I have never taken an American on a motor car trip around Italy. Neither have I run over a child, man or a woman.
Thereupon, General Butler was removed from active duty, subject to trial by court-martial. And on January 29, U.S. Secretary of State Henry Louis Stimson addressed Italy's minister, Nobile Giacomo De Martino.
Excellency, I have the honor to express the deep regret which this government feels at the reflections against the Prime Minister of Italy in the unauthorized speech of Major General Smedley D. Butler, United States Marine Corps at Philadelphia, on January 19th. The sincere regrets of this government are extended to Mr. Mussolini and to the Italian people for the discourteous and unwarranted utterances by a commissioned officer of this government on active duty. Accept, Excellency, the renewed assurance of my highest consideration. Henry L. Stimson.
With the acceptance of this formal note of apology and General Butler's expression of regret, a court-martial was canceled and a reprimand substituted. And Butler returned to duty as commandant of the Marine base at Quantico, Virginia.
1931. That was the year.
That there was erected in the verdant field of metropolitan journalism a headstone marking the death of one of New York's most picturesque newspapers. In 1883, a 36-year-old native of Hungary, who only 18 years before had arrived in America a penniless immigrant, purchased the New York World and dedicated it as
an institution that should always fight for progress and reform, never tolerate injustice or corruption, always fight demagogues of all parties, never belong to any party, always oppose privileged classes and public plunderers, never lack sympathy with the poor, always remain devoted to the public welfare, never be satisfied with merely printing the news, always be drastically independent, never be afraid to attack wrong, whether by predatory plutocracy or predatory poverty.
This was the creed under which thousands of loyal employees of the old world had worked for 48 years. This was the dogma laid down by Joseph Pulitzer. On the morning of February 25th, 1931, 19 and a half years after the death of Pulitzer, the World City editor James W. Barrett stands facing a group of his co-workers.
Close the door, friend.
What's this all about, Jim?
Well, boys, it's come. We're through.
What are you talking about, Jim?
I'm holding in my hands a copy of the files of the surrogate court of this date. The Pulitzer boys have filed a petition pleading for the right to sell the world to the Scripps Howard outfit.
Jim, you don't mean it. You're fooling. Don't joke like that, Jim. Boy, I've worked for the world for 30 years and nobody's
ever... Cut it out, Hank. I'm not joking. It's true. Well, what are we going to do?
Do? Why, you nitwit, you know what we'll do.
We'll raise enough money to match the offer of Scripps, Howard, and buy the world for ourselves.
Yeah, I knew that was what you'd say. Okay, then, we'll start an organization right away, and we'll raise the money. We'll get a lawyer to stop the proceedings and represent us.
It won't work, Jim.
What are you talking about? Of course it'll work.
I'll lay anybody a bet right now that within 3 days, the Scripps Howard sheet will run the flag, the World Telegram.
You're nuts.
Okay, and I'll go you one better. I'll lay you 10-1 that the Telegram scoops us on the story of the final sale.
Oh, come on, John.
As soon as the news spread that the employees of the World were attempting to raise funds to purchase their own newspaper, offers of help came flooding in.
Perry's Drugstore, $5,000.
Alvin Johnson, correspondent for the World in Geneva, $10,000.
The Nashville Tennessean, $200. The Houston Chronicle, $1,500.
The evening following the news of the pending sale, the World employees had raised almost $2 million. But they were still $1 million away from the offer of the Scripps Howard Syndicate. And the Pulitzer brothers were complaining that every day's delay was costing them a loss of more than $5,000. In the early hours of the morning of Friday, January 27, the routine work of sending the final edition of the World to press goes on under the dimming gold dome of the old World building.
Well, Jim, what did I tell you?
What do you mean?
Here's a telegram extra just out. Read it.
Scripps Howard buys New York World. Yeah, they did scoop us, didn't they? On our last story.
And Joseph Pulitzer's historic old New York World passed into history, merged with the New York Telegram.
1931. That was the year
that during three short summer months, aviation history was made.
June 4.
The world's largest seaplane, the German DOX, flies from Cape Verde Islands to Natal, Brazil.
June 23.
Wiley Post and Harold Getty take off from Roosevelt Field, New York. In their plane, the Winnie Mae land 8 days and 15 hours later on the same field, having flown 15,474 miles round the world.
July 25.
The German dirigible, Graf Zeppelin, bearing among its passengers the American explorer Lincoln Ellsworth, makes important discoveries over Franz Josef Land.
July 28.
Russell Boardman and John Palando make their nonstop record flight from New York to Istanbul, a distance of more than 5,000 miles in 49 hours.
On the same day,
Colonel and Mrs. Charles Augustus Lindbergh take off from New York on their trip to Canada, Alaska, Siberia, Japan, and China.
August 8.
The First Lady of the Land, Mrs. Herbert Hoover at Akron, Ohio, christens the world's largest dirigible, the Akron.
August 27.
The giant German flying ship DOX arrives in New York Harbor bearing 72 passengers. 1931, another year of thrilling advancement in aviation.
And that was the year
that the intrepid Swiss scientist Auguste Piccard and his assistant Charles Kipper soared 10 miles into the unknown space above the Earth to explore the mysteries of the stratosphere.
That was the year
that the $60 million George Washington Bridge over the Hudson River was dedicated and officially opened to traffic.
1931, that was the year
that a score of notable world personages met death.
In the field of science,
the Wizard of Menlo Park, Thomas Alva Edison.
In the field of literature,
E.H. Barrington, Arnold Bennett, Saho Kane, Vachel Lindsay, Arthur Schnitzler.
In the field of the theater and music,
the composer Vincent Dandy, Dame Nellie Melba, Anna Pavlova, Alma Rubens, and Eugene Isai, violinist.
In the field of politics,
Senators T.H. Carraway and Dwight Morrow, Congressman Nicholas Longworth and the French World War hero, Marshall Joffre.
In the field of art,
Timothy Cole, woodcarver, Daniel C. French, sculptor, and Ralph Barton, cartoonist.
And in the field of sports,
Sir Thomas Lipton, the British yachtsman, and Notre Dame's football inspiration, Newt Rockne. 20 world personages met death in 1931.
1931. That was the year
the Spanish dictatorship of Primo de Rivera finally ends as parliamentary elections are called for March 1. But with one last clutch at a falling scepter, Alfonso XIII suspends the election and accepts the resignation of his ministry. The election is held on April 12, however, and becomes a test to determine whether the nation wields a monarchy or a republic. The Republican Socialist Coalition swept the country, and Alcalá Zamora called upon the king to abdicate. Replied Alfonso,
"The people are merely angry at me. They are monarchistic at heart. I therefore am prepared to abdicate in favor of my third son, the Infante Don Juan."
And Zamora retorted,
"There is nothing left for Alfonso to do but leave the country and let us rule. If the king does not accept the dictates of the public, we are ready to enforce them and establish a republic ourselves."
The next day, an ultimatum was issued from Republican headquarters.
"If the king does not abdicate within a half hour, the Republicans will not be responsible for the consequences."
Overstaying his welcome by 45 minutes, Alfonso XIII, last of two centuries of Bourbon kings, finally stepped down from the throne of his ancestors and, accompanied by a skeleton of an entourage, sped to Cartagena, where he boarded a ship for France. Another European monarchy had fallen. Another European democracy had been born.
1931. That was the year
that this sparkling song hit first struck the music counters.
Night in Madrid, blue and tender. Spanish moon makes